Samuel 16 to 17, the 12th talk in a series on 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on November 11, 2007 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be continuing on in the book of 1 Samuel this morning. We'll be looking at chapters 16 and 17. I'm going to cover a lot of ground today. Chapter 17 is I think, not enough material, chapter 16 is not enough material, so I'm going to do 16 and 17, but 17 is too much material. So we'll see how it goes, but the plan is to do two chapters. The place where we are in the narrative is Samuel has just proclaimed to Saul that Saul will be removed as king of Israel. God has rejected him as king of Israel. And he is going to be replaced by a better man. That's what Samuel had said to Saul. And Samuel, as it tells us right at the end of chapter 16, Samuel mourned over Saul and what Saul had done. And it's in that state of mourning then that we were left off in chapter 15, and that's where we pick up in chapter 16. So the first 13 verses of chapter 16. Now the Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons." But Samuel said, "How can I go? When Saul hears of it, he will kill me." And the Lord said, "Take a heifer with you, and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord.' And you shall invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. And you shall anoint for me the one whom I designate to you." So Samuel did what the Lord said, and came to Bethlehem. And the elders of the city came trembling to meet him, and said, "Do you come in peace?" And he said, "In peace. I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." He also consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. Then it came about when they entered that he looked at Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Next Jesse made Shammah pass by, and he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Thus Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. But Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen these." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Are these all the children?" And he said, "There remains yet the youngest, and behold, he is tending the sheep." Then Samuel said to Jesse, "Send and bring him, for we will not sit down until he comes here." So Samuel has been grieving over Saul, and as I mentioned last week, I think part of it is personal. I think he probably likes Saul and is sorry that Saul has acted in the way that he has. So it's a personal thing. But part of it, I think, is also Samuel had anointed Saul to be the king of God's people. And Saul had been, was not a good representative of God. Saul turned out to be as I've termed it, a double-minded man. And so I think that's part of the grieving that Samuel is doing as well. If you'll remember back to chapter 8, Samuel had warned Israel that if they had a king, that king would turn out to be, and there the way he described it is he would lord it over the Israelites, that he would turn bad. Well, Saul, there isn't any indication that Saul was lording it over the Israelites, but Saul did turn bad, and it was the kind of thing that Samuel had predicted would happen. So God comes to Samuel when he is grieving, and God says, when are you going to stop grieving? The time's up. We're going to move on. There's going to be a solution to this. And I am going to send you to inaugurate the solution to this problem. That is the anointing of someone who is a better man than Saul, who will become the king of Israel. So he tells him to take oil, and he is going to send him out to anoint the successor. He's going to send him to Bethlehem. He indicates the family that this person is going to be from, the family of Jesse, but he doesn't say who it will be. And it's interesting to me how stingy God is with his instructions. That is, a lot is left unclear. Samuel just has the basic information that he needs to proceed, and the rest will be clarified as time progresses. Samuel's response is interesting. Samuel says, I can't go. Saul will kill me. So we've got a situation here that's quite interesting. Saul has been told by Samuel that he has been rejected as king. So Saul knows that he's going to lose his position, and he's going to be replaced by someone else. But Saul is obviously not going to give up that position easily. Saul wants to hang on to that power. And as we have seen before, Saul has decided that his power was dependent upon the people's acquiescence. So Saul listened to the voice of the people, not understanding that his position is not dependent upon the people's acquiescence. Saul's position as king was dependent upon God. Well, he still hasn't come to terms with that, and he's going to hang on to this any way that he can. And he knows that the way that he is likely to be replaced would be if Samuel, a person who is still of great significance in Israel, he has a great deal of spiritual and moral authority. If Samuel anoints someone else, then that person will be his replacement. So my suspicion is what's happened is Saul has spread news throughout the kingdom that he wants people to keep an eye on Samuel. And Samuel knows that, and knows that if he goes out to anoint somebody, the chances are he's going to be killed. So Samuel raises that objection. God doesn't really give him much assurance that he will not be killed. God just gives him an alternative explanation for why he's going out. All you have to say is that you are going to offer a sacrifice. That's not divulging all of the information that would be true, but it's something that would be less inflammatory than that he's going out to anoint someone else's king. So Samuel goes out. He goes to Bethlehem, and further evidence that Saul is out to get Samuel. The elders of the city come trembling to meet him and said, "Do you come in peace?" You can imagine their predicament. They know that there's tension between Saul and Samuel. They don't want to be on either side because there are two powerful people and they don't want to be taking sides here. They don't want to get in the middle of this conflict. And so when Samuel comes, they're thinking, we don't want to do anything to indicate that we are supportive of whatever revolutionary activities he may be involved in. So they say, do you come in peace? And I think the question they're asking is, are you coming in are you going to come in a way that's going to implicate us in wrongdoing? And Samuel's response is, I'm going to make a sacrifice. And he invites the elders and Jesse and all of his sons to come to the sacrifice that he's going to offer. They come, and presumably the elders are all there, Jesse's there, and six of his sons are there. His six oldest sons are all present. And Samuel thinks he sees the one who's going to be God's designated person. He looks the part. He looks like king material. He's the oldest son. And yet, that's what Samuel thinks. And yet, God says to Samuel, that's not the one. If you will recall, when we first met Saul, he was described as being taller than all of the rest and handsome. It doesn't say that he looked the part of the king, but he did look the part of a king. And he was the one who was anointed, but he turned out to be a double-minded man. Now, as Samuel's looking out at all the sons of Jesse, the oldest one looks the part of a king. And God's response is, no, not him, but he says more this time. He says, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. What God is interested in is a pure heart. What had been demonstrated with respect to Saul is he looked outwardly like a king, but he didn't have the right heart. This designated person is going to have the right heart. So the other brothers pass by one, and each one is rejected. And Samuel's looking around and says, okay, they've all passed by, they've all been rejected, but I'm supposed to anoint a son of Jesse as king. He says, are there any more? And Jesse says, oh yeah, there's one more. That the youngest was out taking care of the flocks. Presumably the reason he wasn't present was he's too young. He's insignificant in that sense. He's not the oldest. You would expect the oldest to be the one who would be designated. He's far from the oldest. He's the youngest. So he was not even invited to come. He was not considered to be significant enough to be present. And Samuel says, then send for him and we'll wait. As it turns out, the one who wasn't invited is the honored guest. He just didn't know it. So that he is sent for, and he will come. The next section. So he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy, with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. And Samuel rose and went to Ramah. Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. Saul's servants then said to him, behold now, an evil spirit from God is terrorizing you. Let our Lord now command your servants who are before you. Let them seek a man who is a skillful player on the harp. And it shall come about when the evil spirit from God is on you, that he shall play the harp with his hand, and you will be well. So Saul said to his servants, "Provide for me now a man who can play well, and bring him to me." Then one of the young men answered and said, "Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is a skillful musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior, one prudent in speech, and a handsome man, and the Lord is with him." So Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me your son David, who is with the flock." And Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread and a jug of wine and a young goat and sent them to Saul by David his son. Then David came to Saul and attended him. And Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, "Let David now stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight." So it came about, whenever the evil spirit from God came to Saul, David would take the harp and play it with his hand, and Saul would be refreshed and be well, and the evil spirit would depart from him. So David is sent for. He comes. He's young, but he's a handsome man. And Samuel, this is definitely the one. Samuel knows that this is the one, and he anoints him with oil, as he had done with Saul a few years earlier. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. When Saul was anointed, if you will recall, the Spirit of the Lord came on him, and he prophesied soon thereafter. So the same thing has happened here insofar as the Spirit of the Lord has come upon David. Then Samuel gets up and he leaves and goes back to his home of Ramah. At the same time that the Spirit is coming upon David, in verse 14 it says, "Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit has come upon Saul at this point." I don't know what this evil spirit is. I don't know whether we're talking about something that's demonic. I don't know if it's biochemical. I don't know if it's just depression. Later on, it's going to be merged with jealousy. And it's jealousy run amok. Whether it's just that now, I don't know. But it is the kind of thing that to one degree or another comes and goes. Sometimes it's more severe, sometimes it's less severe. And one of his counselors recommends that music be used to calm him when this he has these episodes, and music seems to have some kind of soothing effect on it. But I don't really know what it is. One of his advisors suggests music therapy as a way of dealing with this evil spirit, and it's the lyre that is suggested. In the ancient world, the lyre was considered to be a special instrument, and to even have divine qualities. And so it was probably for that reason that this particular instrument was selected, that this evil spirit was seen to be something spiritual and a particularly powerful instrument with respect to the spirit is what should be used. So what's recommended is that Saul find out from among his subjects who is particularly skilled at playing the lyre and bring him to provide music therapy. Apparently, there's a young man within Saul's court who knows that David is particularly skilled on the harp, on the lyre. Not only is he a skillful musician, but as it goes on, he's a mighty man of valor, a warrior, a prudent man in speech, a handsome man, and one with whom the Lord is with. Sounds to me like he's overqualified for the job, but otherwise he's a good candidate. So Saul sends to Jesse to get permission to have David, his son, come and serve in Saul's court. That must have been a significant honor to be selected to serve in the court. Jesse sends a whole bunch of gifts with David, and I think that helps, that reinforces the notion that this is an honor. A donkey loaded with bread, wine, and a young goat that's all sent along with David. David goes and begins to serve in this capacity as a musician. It has a soothing effect, as the advisor had predicted that it would. And Saul responds very positively to David. David seems to be a very likable man, as well as a gifted man. And Saul responds very positively to him. And when David plays, it has a soothing effect. So David becomes a servant in Saul's court. As we'll see in the next chapter, he doesn't serve there full time. He seems to be going back and forth between working for his father, tending the flocks, and other times working in the court of Saul as a musician and as an armor bearer. His status is not just a musician. He's recognized as a man of courage as well. Chapter 17, then, we'll get into the David and Goliath story. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Succo, which belongs to Judah, and they camped between Succo and Azekah in Ephes Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley between them. Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines, named Goliath, from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. And he had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He also had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. And the shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. His shield carrier also walked before him, and he stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine, and you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us." Again the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons. And Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. And the 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul into the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and the 2nd, Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. And David was the youngest. Now the 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flocks at Bethlehem. And the Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. Then Jesse said to David his son, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp of your brothers. Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000, and look into the welfare of your brothers, and bring back news of them. For Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines." for quite a number of years now, we're going to see this constant conflict between the Philistines and the Israelites. Sometimes the conflict seems to be more acute. Other times it becomes less acute. There are times when the armies are constantly on the alert, and other times they seem to be less engaged. At this particular time, the armies of Israel and the Philistines are arrayed against each other in the Valley of Elah, which is just east of Bethlehem. No, west of Bethlehem. Just west of Bethlehem. So if you look at your map and you find Bethlehem, just go straight west. And right where the mountains end and the Shephelah, the plains, begin, that's about the place where these armies were arrayed. And we've got the Philistine army on one piece of high ground, and we've got the Israelites on another piece of high ground, separated by this Valley of Elah. And there is one man by the name of Goliath who comes out on a regular basis and taunts the army of the Israelites. The name Goliath seems to be of Anatolian origin, which would make sense. It is believed that the Philistines were of Anatolian origin, that the Philistines came from what is modern-day Turkey, the shores of modern-day Turkey. They were a Greek-like people. They were like the Trojans or the Mycenaeans, but more like the Trojans probably than the Mycenaeans, who came down to the coast of Israel in about 1200. So they really haven't been in Palestine very long before the time that we're talking about. The time of David is about 1,000, so they've only been there for a couple hundred years. But in those couple hundred years, they had absorbed the Canaanite culture. The Philistines culturally are essentially Canaanites, but their descent is from Anatolia. So it would fit that Goliath, the name Goliath, would be of Anatolian origin. His height is 6 cubits and a span. That works out to about 9 feet 6 inches tall. Such heights are not unprecedented, and in our day and age would be rather lucrative. Historically, there was a man by the name of John Middleton who lived in about 1600 near Liverpool, England, and there is good evidence that he was 9 feet 4 inches tall. There have been people who have been quite tall but haven't reached quite those heights, but usually that comes about because of some kind of pituitary condition, and the growth just doesn't stop. I can't imagine such a person flying on an airplane in our time. He has a bronze helmet on his head, which would have been standard garb for this area if you are a commander in the army, a high-ranking member of the army. But a bronze helmet, we know that Saul has a bronze helmet. By the way, the armor that Goliath is wearing is quite similar to the armor that's described in the Iliad that is worn by both the Greeks and the Trojans. On both sides, they're wearing very similar armor, and that is armor that's very similar to what Goliath is wearing. So a bronze helmet would have been standard garb for a fighter at this time. Scale armor. So it's armor, it's scales, kind of like fish scales, apparently. So they're able to cover the body but still give flexibility. And this is worn over the torso. So his head is covered, his torso is covered, and then he's also wearing bronze greaves, which is exactly what If you've read the Iliad, you'll see the bronze greaves show up on several times every page. So it's standard garb. For weaponry, he has a bronze javelin that's like a weaver's beam. So we're talking about, this is a big, the weaver's beam. It would have been several feet long, and it's tipped with iron. Remember, these are Philistines. They have this capability of making things out of iron, which the Israelites do not have. It's an iron-tipped spear, and the weight of the spearhead, if I remember correctly, is about 15 pounds. So he's not only big, he's strong to be able to use to carry these kinds of weapons. So he's got this big spear. He also has a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. That's probably not a javelin. That's probably a scimitar. So, and whatever a scimitar is, it's a sword that's bent, has a bent blade. And that is apparently somehow harnessed between his shoulder blades. And plus this spear. And then, curiously, he's got this shield carrier that walks in front of him. So here he is, armed head to foot. The only thing that's exposed is his face, and it's not clear whether his arms would have been covered with armor or not. But he's got this little, relatively speaking, he's got to be a little shield carrier that's going in front of him. I don't know what his job is, because he's got armor, but it's got to be an amusing sight. Well, terrifying, I suppose, but a little comic to us. So here's this imposing, I mean, this monster of a man. He comes out and he challenges the Israelites to a one-on-one conflict. He says, "What? Why do we have to fight a war? We'll just take our best man, that's me, and you send out your best man, and we'll just do it one-on-one and be done with it." And this kind of, and whoever wins, their side will take the other army servants. This kind of proposal was often made in the ancient world. If you recall, if you've read the Iliad, the same kind of thing happens between Paris and Menelaus. And if you're familiar with that, as in other stories in the ancient world, no one ever keeps the deal. it doesn't keep them from fighting their war anyway, but the offer is often made. And that's essentially what he's saying and taunting the Israelites. I dare you to come out against me. David, at this time, is tending flocks for his father. And his father wants to do two things. One, he wants to send a care package to his sons who are fighting on the front. And the other thing is he wants to get news back from them. And I can only imagine in those days when communication was difficult how eager parents would have been to want to know how their sons are doing on the front. So that's David's mission. He's supposed to give them a care package and find out how they're faring. So David takes food as well as to his brothers, and he takes something for the commander of the thousand. And by thousand, it doesn't necessarily mean a thousand men. That's just the term for that unit of soldiers. And how big a thousand was varied over time, and I don't know how big it was at this particular time. But to the commander of their unit. And that's interesting that he would be sending money to their command, they're sending food to their commander as well. His three oldest brothers are the ones that are serving there at this time. So David is going to go take that stuff and go and get news from his brothers. By the way, Goliath, this is not a one-time offer that Goliath has made. It says he comes out morning and evening for 40 days. It is, warfare is a strange thing. You read about World War I and World War II, and the kinds of interactions that happen across the front are various curious interactions. Sometimes you develop into kind of a ritual. I know there were instances in World War I where at certain times of the day the Germans would bombard the enemy lines, and it got so predictable that the English and French on the other side, they'd know when it was going to happen, and they'd all go for cover. And then when it was over, they'd all come out and sunbathe and that sort of thing. So warfare is a strange thing, and it becomes ritualized sometimes very readily. And here it seems to have become ritualized. He comes out every morning and every evening and makes this taunt. Next section. So David arose early in the morning and left the flock with a keeper and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. Then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath, named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines. And he spoke these same words, and David heard them. When all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel. And it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches, and give him, will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in accord with his word, saying, "Thus it will be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, "Why have you come down, and with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle." But David said, "What have I done now? Was it not just a question?" Then he turned away from him to another and said the same thing, and the people answered the same thing as before. David rose early in the morning. This phrase, "he rose early in the morning," shows up frequently in the Old Testament, and it almost always indicates someone setting out to do something with determination. He left the flock, and he isn't irresponsible. He doesn't leave the flocks unguarded. He finds someone to be his substitute while he is gone, picks up the food that he's supposed to take, and he sets out. When he arrives at the place where the armies are in conflict, the Israelite soldiers are just leaving camp and going out to the battle lines. And they give out a war cry, and I'm sure this is part of the ritual that's developed. This war cry can't be out of their confidence, because we can tell that they have been clearly intimidated by Goliath. So this is a ritualistic war cry. This is not out of confidence. And David, the soldiers, the Israelite soldiers have just moved out. He puts his stuff, leaves it at the camp, but he goes out to where the soldiers are because that's where his brothers are. And he wants to get word from his brothers that he can report back to his father. While David is out there, he hears Goliath do his little bit, where he comes out, stands before the armies of Israel, and makes his taunt. Once again, This has been happening for 40 days, but once again, the Israelites cower back in fear. And David, I think, is surprised by the response of his, and I think a little bit ashamed by the response of his fellow Israelites. And he begins to talk among the soldiers that are there on the lines. And what he learns is that there has been a reward offered to anyone who is willing to stand up before Goliath. He will be given wealth. He will be given the daughter of the king. And his father's house will be, in my translation, it says free in Israel. What that means is taxes will no longer be collected from that family. So that's what Saul has decided to give as his reward for whoever is willing to go out and fight against this Philistine. David finds out about this by inquiring. He says, "What will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel?" I'm not sure why he's asking. Maybe he would find this motivating, that he's interested in this kind of game. I suspect more likely he wants to know how seriously this matter is being taken by Saul. What has Saul done with respect to this? What is Saul willing to give to have someone step forward and take on this Philistine? And he says, "For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" There is something that's happening here that has for David a spiritual significance. This is not just any old Philistine coming out and trying to get a one-on-one battle. That there's something else going on here that's more significant. That Goliath takes on greater significance than just some Philistine warrior. So David talks more about, asks other people, "What's going on here? What are you thinking about this? And why isn't somebody stepping forward to go out?" And his oldest brother is offended by this. I mean, and you can understand why he would be offended. I mean, this little kid comes up who hasn't been on the lines. He hasn't been fighting. And he says, "Why didn't somebody go out there and get him?" And you can see, well, that would be a little offensive. So Eliab responds not particularly gracefully and says, "Why have you come down? I mean, why are you here? Are you just here to make fun of us? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness?" So he's making it clear, you aren't a person with much responsibility. You aren't someone who really understands what's at stake here and takes it seriously. What's interesting, though, is he goes on and finds an evil motive behind it. "I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle." You're just here to see this happen. You aren't here to risk anything. So there's something wicked in what you're saying and the questions that you're asking. You're just trying to provoke something. And it's interesting. I find that particularly interesting because it is often I don't think that it's true of David. And as we go on and see, he's willing to risk his life here. But what David is doing can look like it is arrogant and irresponsible. And that it is sometimes true that doing the right thing can look like the wrong thing. Next section. When the words which David spoke were heard, they were told them to Saul. and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." Then Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." Then Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head, and he clothed him with armor. And David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, "I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them." And Saul took them off. And David took them off. And he took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag which he had, even his pouch, and his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. So word of what David has been saying to the other soldiers reaches Saul. And Saul wants to find out what it is that David is all about. So Saul sends for David. David comes, and David says that he is willing to be the one who will go out and fight with Goliath. And Saul's initial response is, "Well, this would be a mismatch. You're too young. Goliath is a hardened warrior, an experienced warrior. You're just a young boy. This would be a huge mismatch." And David's response is, "I may be young, but I am also tested. I am experienced. And my experiences have given me courage in situations which would otherwise be very dangerous." In tending his father's flock, it hasn't been in warfare, but in tending his father's flock, he's had confrontations with bears and lions in which he has defeated each of them. And those experiences have given David the confidence that God would, in this particular situation, also help him to be successful in face of his adversary. So Saul, I think rather surprisingly, says okay. He's impressed with David's sense of confidence and presence, and grants him permission. But Saul thinks, you got to go out armed. I mean, you're going up against a monster of a man who is heavily armed. You need to be armed. So Saul gives David his armor so that David can wear that. David puts it on. He's never worn armor before. He puts it on, and he decides, I'm not used to this. I'm not accustomed to how this feels and how to operate with this. And he decides that extra protection would be more of a liability than a help. So he forgoes that extra protection. He apparently decides on a strategy that's based in his experience. He thinks that he sees an opportunity here in that Goliath is so heavily armed that he is slow and cumbersome. And David's thinking, there is an opportunity here because unarmed, I can be quick and nimble. And he is going to try to take advantage of Goliath's one vulnerability and the one place where he is not armed, covered with armor. So he picks out five stones from the brook. Why five? I don't know. It seems to me he'll be lucky if he gets off two. But he picks five stones from the brook, puts them in his pouch, and he's got his sling. Now, I don't know if you know what a sling is. They're a lot of fun. I remember my father made one for me years ago. It's a little strap of leather with a cord attached to both ends of the strap of leather. And you hold the ends of the cords together. And you put a rock in this little pouch made by the strap of leather. And you spin it. And you let go of one string at the right time. And the rock goes out of the pouch with a great deal of speed. And it's a fun little weapon. And what one can become quite accurate with it. I know that because it says it in the Bible, not from personal experience. But it is amazing. With just a little practice, you can get to the place where you can hit stop signs from not too far away. But some people were very proficient with it. Later on, we'll read that from the tribe of Benjamin, that they were particularly good with slings. And I can't remember what it describes, but they can hit a very small target from quite a distance. David must have been well practiced with a sling, and he knew it. So this isn't, he's going against the odds. It looks like he's going into an impossible situation. But there are a number of things that have fallen together here that David sees it as really a golden opportunity, that his experience and skills are a perfect match to exploit the vulnerabilities of this intimidating warrior on the opposite side. Okay, next section. Then the Philistine came on and approached David with the shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy with a handsome appearance. And the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine also said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give it into your hands." Then it happened, when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. Okay, so the Goliath comes forward with his little, cute little shield bearer in front of him. And Goliath is thinking, you know, this is an insult. To send this little kid to fight against me, this is just insulting. And he says, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" Interestingly, apparently the only weapon he sees is the stick. He's not cognizant of the sling being there. And then he curses David by his gods, by his Philistine gods, and says, I'm going to leave you out to be eaten by the birds and the animals. It would have been, in ancient culture, it would have been very much a disgrace to die and not have your body buried. So that's what Goliath is determined to have happen, and obviously very confident of that happening. But David sees this, and I think it's just a combination of things have come together, and we'll talk about this more next week, I think. But David is seeing this as something more than just a one-on-one battle between a Philistine and an Israelite. That because of the way that Goliath is representing himself, that he's representing himself in a way that is hostile towards the Israelites, and more significantly, hostile towards the God of the Israelites. And he's doing it in a way that I think David sees God is going to punish that here and now. God is going to make a statement in history. And David is going to be the agent of that statement. David's response then is, look, you come heavily armed. I'm not coming heavily armed, but I have Yahweh behind me. He says, I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts. And when it's the Lord of hosts, that reference, that phrase, indicates God in his militaristic splendor. And he says, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. And I think he sees that as having spiritual significance here. So he predicts what's going to happen is, I'm going to kill you, and not only will your body be eaten by the birds, but the bodies of the entire Philistine army will be eaten by the birds today. He's going to kill Goliath and chop his head off, is what he's predicting will happen. And why will this happen? So that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. This is a curious thing to say, for the battle is the Lord's. I'm not sure what this means, but I think that David's perspective is God doesn't win his conflicts by superior force in the way that we think about it. It's not, God is not going to lead Israel into victory over its enemies because Israel is the world's military power. God doesn't typically do it that way. God chooses to use what appears in human terms to be weakness to represent him, and God works through that weakness to show his strength. And that's what's going to happen here, and that's what David is predicting. And the battle is the Lord's. I think what David is understanding is this whole battle, this whole conflict is of God's making. And if this whole conflict is of God's making, then he can and obviously will emerge victorious. He can't not emerge victorious. It doesn't matter how much technological advantage the Philistines might have. It doesn't matter how much armor they have. It doesn't matter how many tanks they've got. That the one who is in control of the story itself can and does determine the outcome. I think that's what he means here by saying the battle is the Lord's. So Goliath starts to move forward, and David responds. He runs quickly. He takes a stone, puts it in the sling, and he shoots it at the Philistine. Hits him right in the forehead, in an area that is exposed, where Goliath is vulnerable. And Goliath just falls down. He falls down on his face, which is very interesting. Remember when the Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant? They captured it in battle, and they put it in their temple to Dagon. That on two or three occasions, the statue of Dagon fell down on its face right before the ark. And now we have Goliath falling down right on his face, right in front of David, prostrate before David. I think my translation says that he killed him with the stone. But I think it's probably likely that just knocked him out, because the verb that's used there just means struck him. I think it has knocked him out. He's fallen down. David comes and grabs his sword from him, because David doesn't have a sword, and he uses Goliath's own sword to chop off his head. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. Next section. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of his sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the slain Philistines lay along the way to Shaaraim, even to Gath and Ekron. And the sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps. Then David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem. But he put his weapons in his tent. So Goliath is killed, he's beheaded, and immediately the Philistines run in flight. The Philistines are brave as long as they've got huge numbers, a technological advantage, and a big champion in front of them. But you take any of those things away, and the Philistines scatter. The Israelites chase them as far as the gates of their main cities. The Philistines had five main cities, and Gath and Ekron are two of those, and they chase them right up to the gates of those cities. And then they plunder the camps of the Philistines that they have left behind. David takes the head of Goliath, and he brought it to Jerusalem. I don't know what to make of that. Jerusalem at this time is not controlled by Israel, by the Israelites. Jerusalem at this time is controlled by the Jebusites, who are allied with the Philistines. So I'm not sure, I don't know whether this means that one commentary said that he probably took the head and threw it over the city wall into Jerusalem. Possible. Maybe he took it to some place that was in the environs of Jerusalem. I don't know. The weapons, it says, he puts in his tent. David probably didn't have a tent prior to his coming to the battle lines. Maybe he was given a tent at this point in time, or maybe it's the tent of his brothers that he's sharing with his brothers. It's not clear. In any case, he puts the weapons in the tent, and Goliath's weapons will show up later in 1 Samuel again. Okay, our time has passed. I'll stop here. We'll talk more about this next week, and there are some observations that I want to make. Thanks.